This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Between 2005 and 2013, 10 students in the National College fraternity Sigma Alpha Epsilon died because of alcohol and hazing. Bloomberg journalist John Hechinger reported extensively on the frat, and he dubbed it the deadliest fraternity in America. In his new book, True Gentlemen, The Broken Pledge of America's Fraternities, John explores how Greek organizations became so deeply ingrained in the American college system. John Hechinger is a senior editor at Bloomberg News, a 2011 finalist for the Pulitzer in public service, and on our show right now. John Hechinger, welcome.
Thank you, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Give us an overview of SAE, Sigma Alpha Epsilon. It is a fraternity founded in the antebellum South, right? And it's unique in that way.
That's right. It's the only surviving major fraternity that was founded before the Civil War. It was founded in 1856 at the University of Alabama. So it does have a certain sort of Southern flavor, but it's a national fraternity, which now has something like 12,000 undergraduate members. And more than 300,000 living alumni. There were famous members like William Faulkner from the University of Mississippi and Hank Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary. So it's a very it's a powerful institution.
What attracted your attention? You began investigating this particular frat for your reporting purposes.
That's right. We were looking at fraternity deaths over almost a decade, and we found that Sigma Alpha Epsilon had more deaths than any other fraternity. And we discovered that the fraternity was really close to collapse in a way, because it was having trouble with its insurance rates, and its insurer was actually threatening to withdraw coverage, which would have been the end of a fraternity that had such a long and storied history. And so to me, it symbolized the real threat that fraternities face from litigation, from sort of public scrutiny. And you can see it this year in particular. We've had over the last year 4 deaths of recruits or pledges. We have major public universities thinking about rethinking Greek life, ceasing activities, something like 6 of them in the last several months. And so I think, you know, fraternities are really reaching a kind of a turning point, a kind of crisis.
And whether or not they remain on campus and survive their legal battles will determine how they proceed and whether or not some of this behavior continues or doesn't. You call your book, for instance, True Gentlemen. That is part of the opening lines of the Sigma SAE's own creed, right? Tell us more about that.
Well, I was very interested in looking at kind of the contradiction between the sort of stated ideals of fraternities, which are very lofty, ideals of honor and scholarship and philanthropy, and, you know, the belief that many in fraternities feel that they serve a very powerful, positive purpose, raising $20 million a year for charity, forming lifelong bonds, and a lot of that is real. But from the beginning, I found, going back into history, that this problem of drinking and misogyny and racial divisions really goes back to the founding. And the real question is whether the kind of good can be disentangled from the bad.
It is essential to, or at least it seems to be closely associated with fraternity life. And we talk about some of the ways in which we know misogyny, racism is inherent in some of the frats. I mean, particularly SAE, it was a widely publicized incident, a couple of them, concerning singing songs on a bus that were variations of their theme, et cetera.
Well, that was one of the reasons I wanted to focus on SAE, was that in 2015, a couple of members from the University of Oklahoma stood up on a bus in black tie and sang a song to the tune of "If You're Happy and You Know It, Clap Your Hands," basically celebrating lynching and saying that there would never be an African-American in SAE, except using a much uglier word for African-American. And the fraternity was shut down by its own national organization, as well as by the university. And to the leadership, this was one of the darkest moments, this idea that it was completely out of step with the rest of American higher education. And this is a struggle that SAE and all fraternities have. I mean, I looked at University of Alabama, where Greek life is highly segregated, that there are major, what they call, old row fraternities that have never had African-American members. And this is true really across the South. And it's also a problem that African-Americans are not nearly as represented in historically white fraternities as in the rest of the campus. There's some research that shows it's about 3% as opposed to 15% of all students. So, you know, one sociologist described fraternities as kind of a form of American apartheid, and it's something that colleges are struggling with.
Well, and this is, again, one of the paradox when you trade in this bond that you have and this history that you have, a kind of tradition, and everybody is loyal to the tradition, but when that tradition is rooted in, let's say, white supremacy or misogyny, then you have to ask, everybody has to ask, what is it that we're celebrating, and shouldn't we take another look at how these are organized?
No, I think that's a very good point. I mean, one of the, you know, historically, fraternities were kind of on the wrong side, for instance, of the civil rights movement. One episode that I look at in the book is a meeting that happened in 1951. And it was actually a decision that the fraternity made that, sort of from the modern day perspective, I'd heard great pride in, because at this point, in this meeting in Chicago in 1951, the fraternity had dropped a membership requirement that all men be members of the Aryan race, which was a pretty astonishing requirement to have in 1951, considering that
we just fought World a war, war against II. A guy, yes, who also claimed that was a virtue. But go ahead.
That's right. So in this meeting, they did drop it, but I discovered in looking through their archives a kind of secret transcript of what had actually happened. And what had actually happened is that they said that they were dropping it for public relations purposes, and they were absolutely committed not to accepting African Americans or Jews in the fraternity, and in some very dramatic language. And these were sort of the leaders of SAE that are still celebrated today, and that, you know, many members told me they didn't know anything about this. So, you know, it's time to kind of look at the history and kind of reckon with it. I should say today that there are chapters of SAE that are quite diverse, particularly in places like California. And one of the major figures in the story, Brad Cohn, the national president recently, who really kind of took on this issue, was the first Jewish president of SAE. So there are definitely sort of cross currents. And, you know, the other reason I wanted to focus on SAE is I really felt that, you know, they were quite open with me after I called the fraternity, the Deadliest Fraternity. They welcomed me to meetings. They opened their archives up to me. And after the book appeared, although it goes into some of the worst episodes of deaths and sexual assaults and racism, they felt it was important to kind of reckon with this history. So
and you talk about going on this cruise where these virtues and some amendments appear to be, at least from the top down, where there's a lot of talk about changing some of this behavior. But as you say, there appear to be cross currents within the membership and the leadership.
Absolutely. One of the steps that SAE took is to eliminate pledging, which is the initiation period, where the young men are subject to the rules of the older students, and where most of the deaths occur from excessive drinking. That the four deaths all were pledges this year in all fraternities. So 3.5 years ago, SAE decided to get rid of pledging, which is really one of the sort of signal, you know, symbols of fraternity brotherhood. And there was a lot of pushback from traditionalists. But they stuck with it. They did it because they thought that they might lose insurance coverage. And since then, they haven't had any deaths, and their incidence have plunged like 90%. So I think they also show that a lot of these, drinking deaths are not inevitable. And if fraternities would seriously, enforce rules against hazing and underage drinking if the colleges would hold them to account, that it could really make a difference.
You talked about and highlighted one episode at UNC Wilmington in particular before any of these reforms took place. And I think that that case really illustrates all of the elements that you bring to your story, the way that the kind of old good old boys network and being connected to power and integrated in the university can in some ways slow down the progress in this direction. Tell us about UNC Wilmington.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, one of the major themes of the book is the power of fraternities. I mean, a lot of people kind of dismiss them as a subculture, but they really hold a tremendous sway over universities. So at UNC Wilmington in the fall of 2012, there were three recruits, pledges, who had ended up being hospitalized for alcohol poisoning. And in the last case, the university decided that it was time to shut down that chapter. And they had really compelling evidence. They had a signed statement from one of the pledges that they were asked to drink from a container full of liquor. They had a dash cam video from a police cruiser where one of the pledges was so drunk he actually mistook the police car for a taxi. And this is all on video. And so they were found responsible, even though that pledge actually later recanted his testimony. Presumably under pressure from the fraternity, you'd think that would kind of be it, but the fraternity really refused to accept these sanctions, and the president of the fraternity reached out to the General Assembly, and actually, first step was to encourage the General Assembly to write a law that would allow members of student organizations to have a lawyer in. Present in these hearings, which the university system opposed, and it passed. It's actually named after that law is actually named after SAE and is spreading across the country. And even more than that, the alumni who are very politically connected got two trustees who were SAE alumni to join the board at UNC Wilmington. And one of them told me that the only reason he joined the board was to get the chapter back on campus, and that he told the president that basically they were going to do it their way or it was the highway, basically threatened his job. And sure enough, in the next couple of years, that president left UNC Wilmington. So,
well, talk about too that the lawyer that they got was not just any lawyer. He was the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Republican Tom Goolsbee, who was a sitting senator, SAE alum, and now, as a senator who has, of course, control over the purse strings to some degree, is now defending these students, right?
That's right. I mean, the fraternities, they may seem like small student organizations, but they're a force to be reckoned with. There's even. They even have a political action committee called Frat Pack that's raised more than $1 million and, gives money to members of Congress to sort of fight for fraternity prerogatives in Washington. And, this is only one of many examples in the book of fraternities sort of wielding their power. And there's even have another case where a college president essentially lost his job for trying to rein in fraternities.
We should point out that Goolsbee was, chair of the Senate Judiciary, he's no longer in the Senate. He stepped down during an investigation of his investment firm for fraud, signed a consent decree after he was sued by a number of his clients, investors, for fraud, has stepped down and is on the UNC Board of Governors, but did leave the Senate. But before he did that, he was successful in getting repeal of the Racial Justice Act, which allowed for race to be considered in any kind of adjudication that had happened in legal cases. So an interesting character and a certainly powerful one who came to the aid of SAE.
That's true. I mean, he was not able to sort of be their lawyer, but I ended up getting a transcript of this 175-page transcript of the hearing. And Goolsbee was sitting there next to the president of SAE and kind of, whispering advice into the president's, ear about, how to fight this. So, I mean, just his presence there, I think, shows that this was no ordinary hearing. I mean, you'd think that the fraternity would have been outgunned by the dean and the whole university, but the fraternity was a really a force to be reckoned with.
And so how did that come out?
Well, they, you know, they're back. The latest president, you know, brought them back on campus, and they're back, and they sort of celebrate this as a victory for sort of fraternity rights. You know, there was a feeling that fraternities are somehow stigmatized on campus and that they aren't treated very well. And, you know, I think from the point of view of the members of UNC Wilmington, they felt that they had kind of triumphed over a you know, an unfair administration. But, you know, the other way to look at it is that the university had been trying to keep SAE members safe, and shutting down, you know, the chapter, at least at that point, may have saved some lives. And, you know, the national organization at the time had supported the university. So, you know, you have this dynamic where, you know, you would think that parents and alumni would be most concerned about, you know, saving lives on campus. But, you know, it is extremely difficult.
Well, it's a boys will be boys kind of attitude. In fact, you found a real attention that there were many who see it still, even alums who see it as boys will be boys, let them play, and others who have come to regret their behavior as they grow older. Is there kind of a divide among alums and current members about where the future of fraternities?
I think there really is. I mean, I think there are members of fraternities who feel that, you know, universities are too coddling to students, and that, you know, it's really important that young men learn how to govern themselves and have, you know, bear the consequences of their own actions and not be too heavily regulated. But it's sort of this idea of the freedom to do what they want. But then there are others who feel that, well, what about the rest of the campus? What about, you know, what about a freshman away from home for the first time who thinks, you know, at least ostensibly there's no hazing, and then is subjected to really horrendous hazing, and whose life is at risk? What about, you know, what about his rights? Or the, you know, the young woman, freshman who goes to a fraternity party where, you know, you have underage bartenders who are serving, you know, drinks that excessive drinks, or, you know, where my research shows that, you know, young women who go to fraternity parties run 1.5 times the risk of sexual assault. So, you know, these are competing interests, and I think it's going to be really important how higher education resolves them.
Well, how do you see it going? I mean, you've talked about these cross currents, but is there a trend in one direction or the other? Where are we now?
Well, I mean, I think that this year it's been striking that college presidents have been suspending activities across the country, 6 major public universities sort of suspending all Greek activity. And there's a conference coming up in a few months of some of the Big Ten schools that are really rethinking Greek life. But I should also say that, you know, 4 deaths last year was horrendous and tragic, but it wasn't even a record. In 2012, there were more. There were 7 hazing deaths. So this has been going on for a long time. And, you know, fraternities, I think, are, you know, they're so entrenched in higher education. They're more popular than ever. There's something like 400,000 members, a 50% increase over the last decade. And many students find great value to themselves, and, you know, they form a community. They're more loyal to their university for joining, and they do become big donors and supporters.
University does have some interest in seeing them. So there's conflict even there, you're saying.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, universities market their party life, their Greek scene. They're really endorsing them mostly. So.
Well, and well-connected alums, right? I mean, it's just what you want. You want somebody to go on to be a state senator who can sit next to you and throw the fear of God into it. Well, I mean, that's what you want in a way, because they're also big donors. So I can see the conflict, right?
It is a real conundrum, and you don't, you know, universities tend to denounce fraternities only after something terrible happens, as happened at least 4 times this year. The rest of the time, their websites will basically endorse the fraternities and talk about all the great philanthropy they do on campus.
John, thank you so much, Senior Editor John Hechinger, Senior Editor at Bloomberg News. The book is called True Gentlemen. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Lakota John is next on the State of Things. Stay tuned.